What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Russian President Vladimir Putin orders a draft of military reservists to Ukraine and raises the threat of a nuclear response in the conflict.
The question is, will the West call his bluff and continue with supporting Ukraine or even increase the support for Ukraine? Or will they pause and think what to do next?
Plus, Germany nationalizes ailing energy giant Uniper and why Chinese companies are cashing out on their investments in U.S. commercial real estate. It's Wednesday, September 21st. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. And here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. In a major escalation of the war in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin used a speech this morning to raise the threat of a nuclear response in the conflict and order the country's reservists to mobilize. Without providing evidence, Putin said the top officials at the North Atlantic Treaty Organization had said that it would be acceptable to carry out nuclear strikes on Russia. Putin also cast the mobilization as a response to what he called a decades-long Western plot to break up Russia. Wall Street Journal correspondent Bojan Panchevsky has more on the timing of Putin's remarks.
We have to remember this does coincide with the very successful Ukrainian offensive against the Russian occupying army. So they've pushed them out from a bunch of territories in Ukraine, and effectively Russia is basically at the moment losing the battle in some parts of Ukraine.
Putin's speech also came just hours before President Biden is scheduled to speak before the United Nations General Assembly in New York, where he is expected to renew calls for world leaders to oppose Russia's war in Ukraine. We'll have more on Putin's speech and the West's likely response later in the show. Meanwhile, markets are already reacting to Putin's comments. Oil prices climbed in a sign that the war in Ukraine may be escalating the pressure on global commodity supplies. Other assets considered traditional safe havens also rose, including gold and the U.S. dollar. Investors will also be watching the U.S. Federal Reserve's latest interest rate decision, which is due this afternoon. Germany will nationalize energy giant Uniper, taking a 99% stake in the company and injecting around $8 billion into the ailing business, the government said today. Uniper was Germany's largest importer of Russian natural gas until recently and was hit hard after Russia throttled supplies in recent months, forcing Uniper to buy expensive gas on the open market. Wall Street Journal reporter Julie Steinberg has more.
Germany's move means the company can continue its business operations for now. And what Berlin is doing is trying to save a systemically important company as Europe races to restructure the energy sector. The emergency state support is unlikely to end with Uniper, and German government officials say that they're drafting plans to take control and shore up stakes in local businesses of Rosneft, for example, the Russian state-owned oil giant. And we know that other companies from the energy sector and beyond could also need rescuing.
Turning to the United States, the federal judge tasked with reviewing documents seized from former President Donald Trump's Florida club has held his first public hearing. Judge Raymond Deary said that if some of the seized documents bear markings of being classified, that would be a strong reason not to provide them to Trump's legal team. A lawyer for Trump sought access to those documents, saying the legal team needed to see them in order to inform its potential arguments that Trump had declassified the material, but he did not assert that the former president had actually done so. And electric vehicle demand has pushed lithium prices to a new record, driven by a pickup in EV sales in China. Lithium carbonate prices in China, the benchmark in the fast-growing market, stand at about $71,000 a metric ton, according to price assessment firm Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. That is almost four times as high as a year ago. For years, Chinese firms were among the most aggressive buyers of U.S. commercial real estate. But now, they are running for the exits to the tune of $23.6 billion. That is the amount of net sold properties by Chinese companies since the start of 2019, according to data provider MSCI Real Assets. So what is behind this investment retreat, and what could it mean for the U.S. property market? Wall Street Journal commercial real estate reporter Conrad Pootsier is here with the details. Hey, Conrad, great to have you back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Conrad, so what is behind this exodus of Chinese property investment in the United States?
So first off, I think we need to discuss why they came to America in the first place, right? These are companies in China, often they're not real estate investment companies, and yet in the last decade, they bought billions of dollars worth of office buildings, hotels, and cities like New York. And the reason they came here in such an aggressive way was really twofold. First of all, they saw these buildings as helping their prestige, right? And then the second factor that really attracted them to cities like New York is that they were seen as safe investments. And then what changed in recent years and made them really run for the exits has mostly to do with China. First of all, a lot of these companies, for reasons that have nothing to do with U.S. real estate, just ran into financial difficulties. And one of the ways to raise money is just to sell your U.S. real estate, which is still pretty valuable. Another important reason that really made them ditch the U.S. market was Chinese regulators cracking down on these overseas investments. And the Chinese government basically decided all these companies are taking on too much risk, they're overpaying for assets abroad. And those things together really almost completely stopped the flow of Chinese money into U.S. real estate. And not only that, they really prompted a lot of these companies to start selling most of their assets, which is what we're now seeing.
What does this pullback of Chinese investment mean for the U.S. real estate sector, especially in major cities?
The interesting thing here is that Chinese money was really a small share of the U.S. real estate market, even at its boom times. And yet it had a really outsized impact on prices, on valuations. Because what happened is Chinese companies would often buy the most expensive hotels and office buildings in the most expensive cities, mostly Manhattan. They would pay incredibly high prices. And because they paid high prices for the most expensive buildings, these deals then became benchmarks or comps for other buildings. And so in that way, the impact of Chinese money impacted the whole market. Now, flash forward to 2022, all this Chinese money is gone. And if you're an office owner in New York, right, you're already dealing with rising interest rates, you're already dealing with remote work, weak demand for office space, values are falling. You're really wishing that there was a Chinese company there trying to buy your building for 20% more than anyone else is willing to offer, but that's not happening anymore. And so the impact it's really having is it removed this factor that had really propped up office values for a long time. And it's just like another of many factors that is bound to have a negative impact on the values of office buildings.
That was Wall Street Journal commercial real estate reporter Conrad Pootsier. Conrad, thanks for the update.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Russian President Vladimir Putin has upped the ante amid his country's faltering offensive in Ukraine. We'll unpack his latest comments about nuclear weapons and the mobilization of military reservists after the break.
You're a growing business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
As we mentioned earlier, Russian President Vladimir Putin ended speculation about Russia's next steps in the war in Ukraine today, giving a televised speech in which he ordered thousands more troops into the battle and blamed the West for the conflict, saying Russia would use all the instruments at its disposal to defend itself. Here to help parse Putin's comments and consider how the West might respond is Wall Street Journal correspondent Bojan Ponchevsky. Bojan, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Luke. Good to be here.
What exactly did President Putin announce this morning?
Well, basically, he announced that he would use nuclear weapons if the integrity of the Russian Federation was at stake, which is a major escalation because the Russian nuclear doctrine currently stipulates that these weapons would be used only in an existential threat. So he lowered the threshold. That's number one. And number two, he declared a partial mobilization of the Russian army reserve. And later, his Minister of Defense, Sergei Shoigu, clarified that that means 300,000 people will be called to arms to go and fight in Ukraine.
Regarding the partial mobilization, that is less than had been sort of rumored to possibly be on the table, is it not?
Yes, that's true. I think the Russian Federation has around 2 million people in the reserve. So it's a gradual mobilization. They specifically said they would not be recruiting students from high schools and universities. That's important because obviously the civilian population will be spooked out if they hear their sons will be pulled out of universities, sent to the front line. So I guess it's a gradual escalation in terms of the mobilization, but it is pretty much a one-way street because Russia has been suffering major losses on the battlefield and they're lacking men, they're lacking hardware, they're lacking everything. So it's likely to be a first chapter of more things to come.
And can I just ask you briefly on the nuclear front? You mentioned the threshold being lowered for their potential use in this conflict, but there's still quite a bit of ambiguity about exactly what would occasion President Putin to possibly reach for a nuclear option, is there not?
Yes, it is. But you have to remember, in the same speech, he announced that the people of what he called liberated territories have called for a referenda to join Russia. That means the areas in the Donbass, known as the Luhansk and Donetsk republics. These are kind of pseudo-statelets occupied by Russia, managed by Russia, nominally run by separatist governments. And then there are new occupied territories in areas such as Kherson, and inevitably they will join the Russian Federation. So he said, essentially, any threat to the territory of the Russian Federation could be met with a nuclear response. So does that mean that if the Ukrainian army is fighting on its own soil, basically, which was illegally annexed by Russia, is that now reaching the threshold for using nuclear weapons? That's the big question. And obviously, he left it unclear, but it did seem that he's signaling exactly that. So that would mean, in effect, that when faced with a military defeat of its conventional forces in Ukraine, Russia could deploy, for example, tactical nuclear warheads in Ukraine to kind of push back the advance of the Ukrainian army, which has been victorious in recent weeks.
Got it. So this could go from being a hypothetical threat to sort of an imminent one, depending on how things unfold on the battlefield.
Of course, unless he's bluffing. He did say, however, and I'm not bluffing, he said quite clearly that Russia was now facing the collective West. He said that Western commanders were commanding Ukrainian forces. He said the West has unleashed this campaign of support for Ukraine. He said some leaders of the West have even threatened with a nuclear attack on Russia, which is not true. I don't remember anyone credible making such threats. He said that Russia is already being attacked with long-range weapons from the territory of Ukraine. And so basically he's kind of setting the scene to say that Russia is under attack from NATO. His Minister of Defense, Mr. Shoigu, then repeated that and said that Russia was now at war with the collective West, whatever that means. So essentially he's sending two messages. One message is, if I get beaten down on the battlefield, I will use the nukes. And message number two is, I will engage in global nuclear warfare if you push me in a corner. And that message goes to NATO.
And finally, Bojan, where do Putin's comments leave the West? What kind of response might we be expecting to see?
Well, that's obviously the million-dollar question. I think his comments will put the chills in the blood of some European leaders who are very close to what's happening. Obviously, they're in a very different position. I mean, a country like Germany, for example, will be very carefully listening to his threats. And German leaders have been extremely concerned about the potential of escalation. The leader of Germany, Chancellor Olaf Scholz, has only gradually been increasing military support for Ukraine for fears of escalation. And they always have basically been saying, we don't want this to end in a global thermonuclear war. And now essentially Putin is saying exactly that. He's raising that prospect. He's really upping the ante in terms of his threats. And the question is, will the West call his bluff and continue with supporting Ukraine or even increase the support for Ukraine? Or will they pause and think what to do next? And I think that remains to be seen.
That was Wall Street Journal correspondent Bojan Panchevsky. Bojan, thank you so much as always.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And finally, the Scottish island of Islay is celebrated for its smoky, peat-flavored whiskies. And thanks to growing global demand and beverage companies increasingly being drawn to premium liquor, the island is seeing a further whiskey boom. However, the residents of Islay aren't as happy about that as you might assume. WSJ business reporter Trevor Moss visited the island and explains how the unprecedented growth is creating problems.
having all those distilleries create some quite specific problems. In particular, there just aren't enough houses. And local people are complaining in particular that they are being priced out of the market because whiskey employees come in from outside the island. They have more spending power. Also, the whiskey tourism business is flourishing. So a lot of the houses that are on the island are being rented out through Airbnb and other means. And local people, particularly young people, are just saying they can't afford to stay on the island, and many of them are having to leave.
And this is why we can't have nice things. And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.